Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring myself, Mark Thompson, Lib Dem blogger, and also Emma Burnell, a Labour blogger who blogs at Scarlet Standard. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
We sometimes have guests, we sometimes don't. This week we haven't got any guests, so it's just going to be me and Emma, and we're going to be talking about the political stories that have been being discussed this week. Just to let you know, we're recording this on Sunday, the 9th of December, 2012. So, Emma, I think the first thing we wanted to talk about today was the Chancellor's Autumn Statement, which was released this week. And I think there are a number of issues raised by it that we probably want to cover. I think you mentioned welfare as something you wanted to bring up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously the government have set a real sort of bear trap for Labour, which if you're the government, you're very pleased because Labour are clearly going along with it, because we've had quite strong signals all today from senior Labour figures, including particularly Chucka Rumana, saying that, you know, we would not go along with the 1% rise in welfare rather than a rise with inflation, which obviously, although it's a rise, it's not a real rise. If inflation is above 1%, that means a cut in people at the very bottom, cut in their living standards. So I'm very pleased that Labour have said, no, OK, we get that this is a political trap, but actually it's not something we can morally take the political road rather than the moral road, and are supporting being firm on welfare, but fair on welfare, which I'm really, really pleased to hear, because it's not always been the case in Labour. It's not always been something we've covered ourselves in glory on from either perspective.
In what way do you think this is a political trap?
Well, because, I mean, everybody can see the stuff like the British Attitude Survey, where people in general, when you look at any polling on benefits, people think that there is much, much higher incidence of fraud than there actually is, that people on benefits get too cushy, too easy a life. And, you know, the stories that you get in the Mail and the Express, people with 9 children living in £1 million homes in Chelsea, there are so many of those on a week-to-week basis, despite there being so few of them in reality, that this becomes this idea of that's what being on benefits is like. So to turn around and say, no, that's not what being on benefits is like, it's actually a pretty shoddy, poor, horrible, nasty, hard existence that we shouldn't be making harder for people just because we've all been taught to kick down at the moment. Despite the fact that it's not going to make us popular to say that, we're going to stand up and say that.
So you think it's a political trap because you think Osborne has identified something that he's on, in quotes, the right side of public opinion,
yeah,
and something that Labour will actually be in the minority in terms of support on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's classic Linton Crosby, shirkers and strivers and all those stupid words that nobody actually uses in reality.
Yeah, they are political terms that are thrown about with regularity, aren't they? And I agree with you. When I was talking about this today and I was trying to explain about strivers versus skivers and where it all comes from, I actually found it quite funny. I was listening to Radio 4's More or Less yesterday, and Tim Harford said at one point, and next week we're going to be looking at strivers, so he basically ordered one of his colleagues to do some research on strivation, which just kind of made me laugh, because there's no such thing. It's just nonsense. There's nothing you can quantify about it. What I also find quite strange about this debate is as if it's possible to have a clear dividing line between those on benefits and those in work.
Absolutely.
That doesn't make any sense.
I mean,
most people who claim benefits are already in work. There's not a clear them and us in this sort of situation.
No, and I think that there is, the political dividing lines are very clear, but I think Labour have quite a helpful out, as it were, a wedge that they can start having this debate on, because I think they found that 6 out of 10 people affected by this were actually in work.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was in the small print that was covered was maternity pay, maternity and paternity pay.
Yeah,
so it was kind of, these are part of the parcel of benefits that people do. Oh, not my nice middle class benefits,
yeah,
that I like and I get. I thought you meant those benefits for those people who apparently never open their curtains.
Yeah, so not part of Alarm Clock Britain then. Actually, I'm not going to bring that horrible phrase up.
I was going to be nice to you about the Lib Dems this week, Mark.
It's all right, I'm just getting the digs in early, Emma, before you start. In terms of maternity and paternity benefits, I do wonder if that's the sort of thing. I mean, Osborne, he seems to, with these budgets and pre-budget statements, I wonder if he does it deliberately. He can't do it deliberately. Surely he puts in things that then... No, I was going to say maybe he puts things in that he can then take out later on, because that way he can look like he's compromising. And I'm wondering if anything does come out, maybe the maternity and paternity stuff might come out, just because I think it's a bit too obvious that that's not punishing the Skivers. It's actually detrimental to the Strivers, in quotes, even though I don't really like using those terms, but using the terms of the debate in the way that they would use it.
I think there is a sense that quite often the Conservatives will put stuff in a bill to be negotiated out by the Lib Dems.
Yeah, I definitely got that feeling.
I think one of the earliest examples of that was that 10% cut to job seekers allowance, cut to housing benefit for those who've been on job seekers allowance for a year. And that was just so nasty. And it was part of the welfare reform bill. And, you know, it got cut fairly quickly. And, Lib Dems very much owned that not happening. Then there were a few others along the line. It became such a pattern that it sort of started to feel like, are they just doing this because this is the bill they wanted to end up with, but they had to give their coalition partners a few wins along the way?
Yeah, I got the feeling with the 25, below 25-year-olds not being able to get housing benefit. That just couldn't possibly work. What that felt like to me was it had been drafted by someone who had lived, always had a stable background, and all their friends had always had stable backgrounds, and they knew no one who was in a position where at the age of 18 or 21 wouldn't have had any family to fall back on. That's how it felt, and that's why I just thought, this can never work. And then, surprise, surprise, it wasn't in, but that was seen as some kind of big win for the Lib Dems. Well, what, big win for some ridiculous, unworkable policy to not have been put through? I didn't really feel like that was a big win at all. I feel like if the Tories were in power on their own, they never would have put something like that through, because it just would never have worked. So if we have conceded some of the stuff so that the Tories don't put that in, then that doesn't seem like very good negotiation to me.
I think that's right. But I think it's more likely that stuff gets put in bills for that negotiation stage. I think it's too dangerous a game to play to put stuff in bills to get it taken out during committee stage. And Osborne's just had the worst time since April. I can't imagine him doing it again. So I suspect this maternity-paternity thing has just been overlooked. It's probably something that gets proposed at the Treasury every single time.
Well,
are you about to say the Damien McBride piece?
I am going to say that, because that's one of the best blog posts I've ever
Absolutely.
Read.
Absolutely.
It was fantastic. I mean, I don't know Damien McBride. I've never met him. By reputation, I've heard he's not a particularly nice guy.
Yeah.
But that blog post was fantastic. Just for the benefit of anyone who isn't aware, he went through and picked out all the parts of George Osborne's budget from April this year, which had popped up in some kind of spreadsheet that the Treasury maintains, like a kind of grid of proposed measures. And he just went through all the ones that he'd seen pop up when he was at the Treasury and that he'd shot down, or that other people had shot down, because they were completely unworkable. And somehow this budget they'd managed to get through. And he wasn't really doing it in a partisan way, because he was highlighting how George Osborne had actually been very good on this stuff in previous years. But this time he hadn't been. And it was pretty clear to Damien that George Osborne had taken his eye off the ball. I think he was in the US in the run-up to the budget, and he was distracted by campaigning and other things. But it was for political geeks like me, it was such a fantastic post that just shone a light on how these things are put together, and how things that superficially, so measures that superficially seem like they might be a good idea, as soon as you road test them, they just fall apart. And that road testing just didn't seem to have happened in quite a lot of cases in April. So this budget felt, well, it's not even a budget, is it? But it does seem these days like we have two budgets a year, because we have the actual budget and then we have a pre-budget statement, and loads of measures are announced in that as well. But in this particular set of announcements, it felt like things were a lot tighter. But that maternity and paternity thing does seem
like
an oversight to me. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, there were, as I said, so far this budget hasn't fallen apart, which is a, you know, so an improvement on April. There were some measures in it which even I thought were quite sensible. I thought the increase in the allowance to buy machinery and plant for businesses was actually quite a good idea, because that will be quite stimulating for the, you know, the manufacturing side of the economy, which is where the government have decided to focus their energies.
Yeah, and I saw some comments on the news from a couple of people who work for companies where that is going to make a big difference. And I think it's worth pointing out, he hasn't just increased it a bit, he's increased
hugely.
It tenfold. Yeah, it used to be 25,000 a year, it's now 250,000 a year. So I could imagine there are some companies for which that would be a huge benefit. Have to say, declaring my interest, I run my own company, and in my case, that's not going to make any difference to us at all.
No, it's not every company that will, but if you are in the large-scale manufacturing sector, let's hope, please God, for the sake of the economy, it will mean some more orders coming, because I think it has been very, very noticeable that people are riding out this recession. And they don't think it's ending anytime soon, whether, you know, technically we're not in recession at the moment. But people are sitting on their capital. They're not spending and they're not investing. And hopefully measures like this will increase investment somewhat. I still think Vince Cable's probably right. And we're probably aiming for a third dip.
Yeah, I fear that. Well, I wonder if we might not quite end up with a technical third dip, but we might have another quarter of contraction. I think it has to be two further quarters of contraction, doesn't it?
Yes, one quarter gets you out and two get you in, which I think seems a bit bizarre. But
yeah, I did a blog post about this last year, with the whole definition of what's a recession and what isn't seems quite surreal, really, because there are some scenarios where over a year the economy could grow by 1% and you'd consider to have been in a recession, and there's another scenario where the economy could have shrunk by 1% over the year and you won't have been considered to have been in recession. It is a bit strange, but then I suppose you've got to have some kind of definition, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, you've got your economic definitions and you've got the way people feel, and I think that nobody feels like, I don't think anyone's feeling any green shoots. Certainly, that's not the impression I'm getting when I'm going out and talking to people.
Well, let's face it, after Norman Lamont and Shriti Vadera, no politician's going to dare to talk about green shoots anytime soon, are they?
Well, no, but I'm not talking about politicians. I'm talking about people and the money they've got in their pocket and how much we've got to spend and just to live on. Yeah, it doesn't seem to be to me that people are feeling improvements. And I think we're probably going to bump along the bottom for a good while yet. And we may well be downgraded, which will affect the cost of borrowing.
I'm not sure it will, because I tweeted about this the other day. And I was asking, what difference is it going to make if Fitch's downgrade us from AAA to AA? And I got quite a few responses, actually. Some of them from people who I got the feeling seemed to know what they were talking about, and with a few links to various things. And I had a bit of a look, and I think quite often the markets, if your credit rating is kind of on the cusp of being downgraded, or it feels like that might happen in the near future, then apparently the market's priced that in anyway. So even if there was actually a technical reduction in the credit rating, I'm not convinced it would make a huge amount of difference. But I think that I'm talking about from an economic perspective. I think from a political perspective, it would make quite a big difference, because George Osborne preening himself saying, you know, we've got this AAA status and it's vitally important that we keep the support of the markets. Once even one of those credit rating agencies marks us down, it makes it harder for him to make that argument. And of course, you know, I'm sure there's all kinds of hand gestures that Ed Balls can come up with across the dispatch box to demonstrate that we've been downgraded. You know, maybe like his finger pointing down, or like two A's made with his hands or something. I don't know.
YMCA, they can have the whole bench doing AA.
That would be brilliant if they could just kind of, you know, segue into that at some point. I look forward to that.
Excellent. Next time I see Ed, I shall suggest it.
So was there anything else in the autumn statement that you thought was worth talking about?
I think those are the main... I mean, the fuel thing was kind of expected and probably a good idea. I mean, I'm very in two minds about fuel taxes because I am a green.
So am I. Well, you know, I consider
I'm a newly driving green, though. So actually, I was really, really surprised because I went to fill up my car for the first time. I've got a new car. Well, it's not a new car. My brother emigrated and gave me his car. And I went to the pump to fill up my car, and I had been told how expensive petrol was. And I filled my car up completely. And it was only 40 quid. And I'm like, this is what you're all moaning about.
Emma, what car is this? Because we got a car recently. The first time I had to fill it up from empty, it was 120 quid.
Bloody hell.
But then, to be fair, I'm sure it's a bigger car than yours.
Yeah, very much a little dinky little thing.
Well, I was going to say, when I'm...
Okay,
Oh, a Ford car?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay. I wouldn't be seen dead in one of those things.
And this isn't the time nor the place, but honestly, it's a right nippy little thing.
Yeah. Well, we got a car, we got it off one of our relatives, and it's a Volkswagen Touareg, and it's massive, and it's got a huge tank in it, and I don't know what it gets to the gallon, maybe 30 to the gallon. It is diesel, which I think is a bit better than normal petrol. But yeah, £120 it cost to fill it up, and that really took my breath away, because the most I'd ever paid for filling up a car before then was about 75. So... yeah, I'm a bit in two minds myself as well, but I just think the political...
Yeah.
It was politically necessary for Osborne to do what he did. And I actually thought the way he announced it was almost like, well, come on, it was obvious you were going to do it. So, you know, he said, I don't think we should delay it for 3 months. Dramatic pause. I think we should abolish it. Whee! And I don't know, I just thought that was all a bit contrived and a bit pointless, really.
I also think...
Was it Robert Halfen is his name?
The Harlow guy.
He was the Tory MP who'd been campaigning on this for quite a long time. And I did notice the next day a couple of people saying, you know, what Robert Halfen, I think there's something else he's campaigning on, some other issue, or someone was suggesting he should campaign on another issue. As if he's somehow magic, as if it was him that's managed to do this. When actually, I think any MP that had latched onto this issue, given where we are economically, would just have won eventually. So I don't...
Yeah.
I think he picked... Let's put it this way. I think he picked an easy issue to campaign on. Someone like Andy Burnham picking Hillsborough over 23 long years, that's a difficult campaign to fight. I think going with the grain of public opinion about reducing petrol prices is an easy fight to pick.
Although I have to say about Robert Halfen, to be fair to the man, he doesn't always pick easy fights, because he's written a pamphlet about why the Tories should be more engaged with the unions. It's actually very thoughtful and a very good argument. And obviously,
what is his argument?
Basically, that these are 7 million people, not all of whom vote Labour, and they are, you know, there to make workplaces better. And if you don't engage with them, they're likely to get more and more left-wing and more narrowly focused. Whereas actually, they are the big society in action if you get involved and engage with them properly.
That is interesting, because he's right. And yet it does often feel that the Tories just don't think like that and don't believe that.
And it's often forgotten that Margaret Thatcher was a trade unionist.
Yeah, although she certainly wielded a big stick when it came to changes, didn't she?
She did. And, you know, obviously that was in large part because of the relations between the trade unions and the government in the 70s, and what happened during her reign. But... there is a difference between people who are against the most extreme examples of trade union behaviour and people who just don't like the unions.
Mm.
And it's very, very wrong to lump the unions. I mean, obviously, I have a professional stake in this. I work for the TUC. I'm not speaking as someone who works for the TUC at this point. You know, the unions as an organisation do amazing things all over the country in so many different ways and so many different people's lives. And not just the 7 million people who are members, but actually they reach right out into communities. They reach lots of big, big businesses, lots of FTSE 100 companies have amazingly good relationships with their unions who help them to negotiate with government. For example, up in Ellesmere Port, Unites were a really key part of keeping that plant open.
I thought it might be a good idea to talk about, because kind of referring to the autumn statement, and I know there was an announcement on corporation tax, and I think it's going to be reduced
again.
large companies. Yeah, but not for small companies.
No.
They have already reduced it slightly for small companies. This always irritates me when people say, oh, corporation tax has come down again. Yeah, for the big boys.
Yeah.
For the small boys like me, it's sticking at
20%.
Really, which
is, have an SME-like thing at all.
Which is very surprising for Tories.
Yeah.
You'd expect that the Tories would be all over small and medium enterprises. And for some reason, it seems not to happen. But it's difficult for me to talk about this without seeming like I'm talking in my own self-interest. But I do think that what Osborne's actually trying to do is align the large companies and the small companies rate, because it used to be large companies rate was 28% and I think small companies rate was 22%. Well, now I think small companies is 20% and large companies is 21%, yeah. Or will be soon. It's not going to be long before they end up in lockstep, and once they're locked together, I wonder if they'll just abolish the distinction and say this is the level of corporation tax and just say this is the rate whatever, and then they won't be decoupled again in future.
And then that'd be very dangerous, because
I agree
that you can and should tax a large company that has a monopolistic approach to market very differently from a greengrocer's.
I agree. But I think what's quite interesting about this subject is that all the protests that there have been in the last week, particularly with Starbucks, because that's all about basically them not paying tax, or at least not paying corporation tax. I find this subject a bit, I wouldn't say difficult to follow, because I think I do understand the issues, but I almost feel a bit despondent about it, because the globalised nature of the economy now means that surely it just is very difficult to be able to get these companies to pay corporation tax, because it's not just that they're not doing anything illegal, which they're not, or, well, the ones that are should be taken to task and prosecuted and all the rest of it. But as far as I can tell, the ones that people are complaining about, Starbucks and Google and who's the other one that's been in the news recently?
Amazon.
They're not doing anything illegal. What they're doing is they're making sure that they do things in such a way as they pay tax in lower tax jurisdictions. And as a globalised company, there are all kinds of tricks that you can do to make that happen. I would guess, I mean, my company isn't globalised, so we don't do any of this stuff. But I do just wonder, in the end, these campaigners, what they expect the government to do about it. Because I can't really see, the government can't suddenly make the economy not globalised anymore.
No, but, I mean, there are a load of loopholes that could be closed. I mean, it's probably more complicated with Amazon than it is with Starbucks, because Amazon don't have to be based in the UK, and they could send their packages from somewhere else. But you can't go to a coffee shop in France. Do you know what I mean? So where and the contention with Starbucks and Amazon and Google is they claiming that they haven't made any profit in the UK, whilst there is provable and documentary evidence that they have. Several of their annual reports say that the UK is one of their strongest profit bases.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I think Liberal Conspiracy had it. No, Political Scrapbook. It's well worth a look. I mean, it is, you know, quite blatant. So what they're doing is moving the profits from the UK to other places where they don't have to pay tax, which is traceable and manageable by a decent beefed up HMRC, which we don't have. What the protesters should be asking the government to do is close the loopholes properly. I mean, I'm slightly at odds with the idea of aiming the protest at the companies who are not behaving illegally. If they're behaving illegally, then fine. Yeah, absolutely, we should protest them. But I think the thing to do is change the way the law is implemented and the way the law is written, and make sure people are unable to do these things, rather than saying you shouldn't do these things, it's morally wrong, because capitalism is amoral. It's not immoral, it's amoral. It's not a moral thing. So
I like it when people make the distinction between amoral and immoral.
Yes.
The thing about Starbucks, it irritated me when I saw this, though, recently, because I thought, okay, Starbucks, 14 of the last 15 years haven't made any profit, apparently. You're telling me that there's evidence that that's not the case, but that was,
I mean, it might be Amazon, but I think that the problem is the definition of profit is a bit.
Yeah, there's all kinds of ways in which you can say that you had to buy things from another part of your company in another part of the world, and the amount that gets charged for those things can vary and fluctuate and so on. And there's all kinds of ways in which you can do that. But the thing that irritated me is that there was all this focus on Starbucks, and there were all these planned protests. And then Starbucks said, OK, well, we're going to pay more tax than we have been doing, and this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And then the protests went ahead anyway.
Yeah, that seemed a bit odd to me. It's like, you've got everything you want, don't go protesting. Because then protesting look like an outing. And
exactly.
Protesting is and should be more important than that.
That's exactly right. That's what annoyed me about it, because I went on Twitter and I said, why are they still campaigning? And a few people came up and said, well, you know, all Starbucks have done is said they're going to pay a bit more tax in the next couple of years, but nothing about the historic stuff, and they've made no promises for the future, and blah de blah de blah. And that, I'm sure that's all true. The point is, they actually made a pretty massive gesture. Yeah. They promised to pay £20 million in tax in the next couple of years. And yet the protesters just seem to not even acknowledge that. And they just went ahead with the protests. I think it devalues protest. I think it disincentivizes other companies from making gestures like this.
Yeah.
Because they'll think, what's the point? We'll still get the protests anyway. We might as well not bother. And yeah, and it really just did feel like they'd all booked their train tickets and their coach tickets, and they decided to do it, so they were going to do it anyway. That just didn't seem right to me. And I think, yeah, I think the next time they find themselves in a situation like that, they need to think a little bit more carefully. The other thing is, I said, why aren't people protesting Google and Amazon? Why is it all focused on Starbucks? And some people said, well, Starbucks has high street visibility. Well, that might be true. But if that's your criteria for who you're going to protest against, then there's going to be loads of companies that are going to be getting away with this. Yeah. Because people aren't going to protest against them. So again, I think you've got to be a little bit careful about how you're choosing the companies you're going to protest against.
And the other thing that concerns me is that the baristas who work for probably quite poor wages, I don't know for certain, so I hope I'm not getting us in any trouble with Starbucks, but yeah, they're probably not, you know, on 50 grand a year, are not the ones who are avoiding their tax, and they're the ones having to deal with people in their shops protesting. And it's the same when people were going into HSBC. You know, we need to differentiate between bank clerks and bankers. Mm. And, you know, these are not well-paid people. These are people, probably a lot of them more working class than the people who were protesting. And that whole, I don't go to Starbucks, to be honest with you. I drink instant coffee. I have no class.
I don't even drink coffee, so.
There you go. But I understand that what they do is they write your name on the cup, and you have to give them your name, and then they call your name. So I've got a half-cap skinny latte, whatever, for Mark. And people are going, oh, I'm taxpayer. And I just thought, well, yeah, that poor kid sitting behind the counter at Starbucks making your stupid coffee order is not the one you have a beef with. Protest is great, and protest is good in the right, done in the right way. And you know, I've been on both the big demos in London, asking for a plan B, a different alternative to austerity. But it has to be aimed at the right people, and it has to be done in the right way. Otherwise, what you're doing is basically bullying poorly paid kids.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, whenever you're coming up against a large corporation, your interface to that company is usually people who are not earning very much money and whose fault it very much is not that you're angry with that company. I mean, you know, an example of that is, you know, if you call a mobile phone provider or insurance provider, you always end up speaking to someone on the end of the phone, and you know it's not their fault. And actually, they're probably as annoyed with the situation as you are. They're probably annoyed 100 times more than you are, because they're having to put up with all the complaints about whatever the policy is that's caused the problem.
But these companies have head offices. They have, you know, offices for high-level executives in London that you could go and protest at.
Absolutely, and I think that they should be focusing more on that. But I guess it makes better coverage for the news, doesn't it, if they're all camped outside a particular shop.
Yeah.
And a shop is something the public can connect with a bit more, they can understand a bit more, can't they? So I suppose I can see why they do it that way, but I agree. Just before we get sucked into to more, because we kind of agree on this, I think.
Yeah.
So maybe we should draw a line under that one. Something we might not agree on so much, though, is pluralism, which I think was something that you wanted to talk about in the context of Andrew Adonis saying that now he doesn't think that Labour and the Lib Dems should form a coalition in the future. Is that right?
Well, it was more, and I read the Andrew Adonis thing, but there was also this week, there was a new group within the Labour Party launched called Labour for Democracy, which...
Shouldn't that be a tautology?
Well, yeah,
Labour just for democracy anyway?
Is that revealing
something?
How do you
something?
Have, you know, Labour for... hugs and puppies.
Yeah.
You know, it just, you know, that's kind of, we're a democratic political party. It says so on my membership card, you know. So, yeah, I think it is insulting. The name itself is insulting to people who may not agree with or prioritise necessarily the goals of this particular organisation. I mean, I think there are different ways to look at this. I've written before about the fact that we should plan for a hung parliament, but I don't think planning for a hung parliament and campaigning for a hung parliament are the same thing. And I think that this group are made up of people who too often are interested in kicking Labour and campaigning for a hung parliament. And when they do that, what they do is upset people who they should be trying to get on board, and they just end up talking to their own very self-satisfied, very insular group of people that never, ever go out. You know, the same problem and a lot of the same characters as the old democracy movement issue that we've talked about before.
So who are the movers and shakers in this new organisation then?
Well, I think I said to Mark Ferguson on from Labourist on Twitter, when the answer is Neil Lawson, the question is never anything good.
You see, I did wonder if Neil Lawson might be behind this, because he is one of the usual suspects in this sort of thing. I've seen him speak, I think, at 3 fringe events at Lib Dem conference in the last few years now, and he's always talking about the same sort of thing. Yeah. He's always trying to put the parties together. And actually, from the floor, you always get the same sort of responses, which is, well, it's all very well talking to people like you, Neil, but, you know, there are lots of people in Labour who don't want anything to do with the Lib Dems.
And vice versa.
Well, yeah,
I mean,
I walked
around Lib Dem conference. I went to Lib Dem conference for the first time this year, as you know, and the hatred for Labour there, and the idea that Labour are the only tribal party is a nonsense. Visceral hatred of Labour from the Greens and from the Lib Dems. And if you pretend that it's all Labour's fault that we're not all cuddly bunny friends, then you're going to get nowhere.
No, I wouldn't pretend that. And actually, I think most of those fringe events that I sit in like that tend to be populated by people from within my own party who are more receptive to pluralism and so forth. So there is a danger that you almost just end up talking to the people who kind of agree with you, and you don't recognise that there are factions like there are factions in every party. But I think maybe one difference with the Lib Dems is that because one of the defining policies of the Lib Dems is electoral reform and proportional representation, the natural consequence of proportional representation is that you would have to deal with other parties. Just pretty much every time there was a new election, parties would have to form coalitions. So I think there is more of a pluralistic tendency within the Lib Dems than there is within Labour. But I have met plenty of people in Labour, and I know plenty of people in Labour, who are willing to compromise and seriously think about coalitions and so forth. I have to say, though, I do think after the previous general election, I do think Labour were caught on the hop a bit with the whole coalition negotiations, and I don't think they'd thought it through. Surprisingly, as much as the Tories seem to have thought that process through more than Labour. Maybe it's because Labour had been in power for so long that they'd kind of fallen out of the habit of thinking about how to cooperate with other parties. I don't know. But maybe that's why this particular Labour for Democracy movement has cropped up in order to try and address that deficit. Sounds like you might not agree with me.
I don't really agree with you, because I don't think there are a few people involved in this group that I have a great deal of respect and admiration for. Jessica Sarto, who is our PPC for, I think it's Norwich North.
Yeah, but she's also a councillor in Islington.
She's also a councillor in Islington, and is someone who over the years I've come really around to in many ways. We're from different traditions within the Labour Party, but I think we've kind of met in the middle. So I have a lot of time for Jess. But I don't think that a lot of the people involved, apart from John Denham, are the people who are going to be doing that kind of high-level planning. And I think when you announce something public like this, that's quite different from doing the behind-the-scenes planning that would absolutely have to be done. I think what I said was preparing for a hung parliament publicly looks defeatist. Not preparing privately would be foolish. And I think that's the line to be walking, rather than launching a basically Compass 2.
I really hate, though, that in this country you're not allowed to openly talk about potential coalitions in advance of an election because it looks defeatist. I really, really intensely dislike that fact. I recognise it's a fact. I think it's one of the problems from before the election in 2010 that if we'd have had a more open political discourse and political environment, then the Lib Dems could have been perhaps more straightforward about some things. They could have been more honest about some things, and maybe all parties could have been more honest about some things. I mean, one example is when you read the Labour manifesto and the Conservative manifesto, they always talk about, we will do this, we will do that. It's all will. And I think previous Lib Dem manifestos had been more nuanced in the language and their approach, and they'd said we will fight for this and we will try to achieve this and blah de blah. But I think by 2010, even the Lib Dem manifesto, because they were trying to seem as much of one of the big boys as Labour and the Conservatives, that the manifesto was full of we will do this, we will do that, as if they were going to form a majority government, which was just clearly not, it just couldn't have been the case. And yet Lib Dems basically had to pretend that they thought that they could form a majority government in order to just be able to get to the table with the big boys and talk about it in that way. And that just seems silly to me. It seems really silly. I wish that politics could be more grown up and that parties could be more honest about that sort of thing. But
I agree.
They can't. They can't because their opponents would just attack them in exactly the way that you've just said.
I don't think this is just about the opponents attacking them. I think that's the wrong way of looking at it, actually. I look at it from almost a completely opposite perspective. I think that there are Labour activists in every seat in this country, including in Witney or Tatton, all those really, really safe seats, safe Tory seats, who deserve a sense that we're fighting to win and a sense that they're part of this much, much bigger movement to fight to win an election. It's not much fun. When I was a student, in Canterbury. It was a very, very safe Tory area. It's not much fun fighting elections you know you're going to lose. But one part of that is this collective whole that you're part of. If that collective whole isn't even, got the energy to say we will and we must win this, then, I just think that's disrespectful to the members.
Well, that's easy to say for a Labour activist and probably easy to say for a Conservative activist because, those people will both be in parties that have, over the last 100 years, had a decent number of decades where their party has been in overall power. For a party like the Lib Dems or the Greens or UKIP or any of the other party, any other minor party, that's not realistic. So unless you're in one of the two big parties, this idea that you're going to win is just not realistic. What is realistic, like we've found, is that the Lib Dems could and are in government, but albeit sharing power. And that's the problem that I have, that the whole political culture is set up for one party to have absolute power and for the other parties to all be in opposition. And the fact that 2010 was an anomaly over the last 60, 65 years, I think it even threw the civil service into a bit of turmoil because no one within the civil service had ever, in the living memory of the civil service, actually dealt with a coalition. So the whole political structure just wasn't set up for it. And I would hope that now that we've had one, that things will be a bit different, but I fear that they won't be. I fear in the run-up to the next election, we'll just end up getting the same sort of stuff that we got last time. I also have to say, and you must have known I was going to say it, and I am going to say it, those Labour activists in Witney and those Labour activists in Tatton, if we had proportional representation, single transferable vote with multi-member constituencies, they'd have a decent chance of getting maybe one or two MPs in their, multi-seat area, and they'd have something really positive to fight for. In first past the post, you were always going to get areas where, parties are either moribund or barely exist just because there is no point and it's so difficult to get a foothold in.
You might say that, but it's Labour people in Surrey that I know that were most against the idea of AV, because why do you do this unless you're going to get a government overall? And that was their feeling, even though they were never going to get local councillors, never mind MPs. So and they were the people who were strongest in favour of first past the post, despite it not benefiting them individually. Maybe that's,
well, that's
the Labour collectivism thing.
That's very noble of them. But I have to say, I live in a very safe Tory area, but I'm a Lib Dem, so it's very easy for me to say I'm in favour of electoral reform. That's one of the reasons I joined the party. but yeah, it is quite depressing to be in an area where you just know you haven't got a chance of winning the seat. And I mean, at the moment, we haven't got any borough councillors. I think we've got a couple of town councillors. But yeah, it's very, very difficult. And yeah, I can understand what you're saying. For the fight for the overall party, I can see that there's an argument for that. But I think it would help re-energise parties if in individual areas they had more than just the national party to fight for and their pride, effectively, and they actually had a chance of winning, you know, maybe an MP in a multi-member constituency. But I think I could talk about this for hours, as I regularly do. I think we are nearly out of time. One thing I did just want to briefly talk about, maybe we'll talk about this more next week. It's a bit of a habit that we're getting into with this podcast now, where we talk about something that's almost a kind of preview for the week coming. But the Home Affairs Select Committee has, well, by the time people are listening to this, they will have released their report. So currently it's Sunday, and the Mail on Sunday actually broke the embargo today and published a story about it. And essentially, the committee, which is a cross-party committee, has said that there should be a Royal Commission with one of the options on the table of legalisation for drugs, and they should be regulated in that way. And I'm a long-time campaigner for reform of drugs laws, but I wonder what's going to happen with this one, because I've been here before, I've seen this happen before. There's been plenty of committees, both parliamentary and outside parliament, that have reported on this issue over the years, and all that ever happens is the government says, we're not going to do it.
Yeah.
Full stop. And actually, I've seen it. I saw a comment from the government already, even though this report hasn't been released yet, in response to the Mail on Sunday story, which is basically drugs are bad, drugs are dangerous, the current policies are working, there's no need for a Royal Commission, we're not doing it. I just wondered what your thoughts were on this, Emma, just very briefly. Maybe we'll pick it up next week.
Well, I mean, as you know, I feel the same way as you. Slightly nuanced differences about legalisation. I don't think that prohibition works. My concern about legalisation is about internationalism and working with an international framework rather than empowering criminal gangs abroad by legalising drugs over here, but given everyone's buying them over here anyway. I think that it will not happen. I mean, you know, we both think it won't happen. It won't happen, and it won't happen, and it won't happen, and it won't happen. And eventually society will change and our mores will change, and that's when it will happen. But until that happens, and, you know, we may be getting there, but we've had many, many false dawns before.
Do you know what I actually think is more likely to happen? Maybe we can go into this in more detail on another occasion. But I think the fact that in the US, you've already got a number of states now, quite a few states actually, that have medical marijuana laws, and now you've got some states where marijuana has effectively been decriminalised completely. I think that that domino effect, because I think what will start to happen in the US is other states will see that the sky hasn't fallen, and these states are actually doing quite well and getting tax revenue, and just generally it's a policy that is working, and there'll be a domino effect and loads more states will pick it up. And before you know it, the US will have legalized marijuana effectively, and it's the US that is most has historically been most strongly in favor of the very firm international treaties to prevent countries from actually legalizing drugs themselves. And I think that whole house of cards will start to collapse. And I think that the politicians in this country, well, the politicians that are in power in this country, people like Cameron and Osborne, and maybe to an extent Nick Clegg, fear that the time isn't ripe for a discussion about this yet. Having said that, when I interviewed Nick Clegg at party conference, I asked him about this issue, and he did actually say that when this committee reports, that he is going to read it with an open mind, and that he really does think the onus is on the government to take seriously what the committee says. I don't know if he had any inkling of what they were going to say, but I think given what committees have said in the past, even one that David Cameron was on and signed up to in 2002, which pretty much said the same thing. And I've actually got a piece, so if people listen to this on Monday the 10th, I've got a piece on Lib Dem Voice today, which basically calls for Nick Clegg to make the Liberal case for drug legalisation. For drug policy, a Liberal drug policy. I don't think I went as far as saying he should call for legalisation, because I don't think he will. But I think he should definitely agree with the report and call for a Royal Commission on the subject. I'm hopeful he will. He certainly seemed to be receptive to that when I talked to him, but I guess time will tell. Maybe by the time people are listening to this, they'll already have the answer. Who knows?
Who knows?
Okay, well, we'll leave that there, and maybe next week, once it's reported and we've got some political reaction, we could pick this up again. So thanks for your time, Emma, today.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank Audioboo who very kindly hosts the podcast. And I'd also like to thank Kev McLeod at Incompetech.com for our funky theme music, which I hope everyone appreciates. And we'll be back next week.
Cheers.